From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day when the state of Alaska is leading the way in the country, actually. It is the first state to open up entirely. No more restrictions, no more lockdowns, back to the status quo ante. That means the way it was before. In Florida, they are opening up at least part of the Disney Springs Entertainment Center. Not yet opening up all of Disney World, but that is probably on the way. And the crowds have been light there, and they say that's a good thing because it allows more social distancing. Everywhere across this great land, there are new stirrings of, dare I say it, economic activity with the opening up from lockdowns. But that doesn't take away from some of the sting by critics like Alex Berenson. He's been a guest on this show frequently because he wrote one of the most important books of last year. It's called Tell Your Children, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. He also has gone against the grain on the whole issue of the lockdown policy, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show. Alex, I appreciate your coming on the show. Do you feel that this process of the opening that is unrolling in a federalist style, different ways in different states, is that going reasonably well?
No, it's not going reasonably well. It's going far too slowly, and it's nice that Alaska has reopened. But, you know, Alaska has fewer people than, you know, four of the five New York City boroughs. The biggest states, two of the four biggest states have barely reopened, or, you know, have really not reopened at all. And of the 10 largest states, most are lockdown states. I recognize that there's not much that the federal government can do about this, but the fact that, you know, Georgia, which is also a large state, reopened, you know, partially and increasingly almost a month ago now, and has actually seen a drop in the number of hospitalizations related to a coronavirus should tell us a lot, and it should tell us that these reopenings should be coming more aggressively now. In fact, there was a paper that came out from J.P. Morgan. You know, J.P. Morgan, they're not epidemiologists, but they also have no truck in this. They can make money whether there's a lot of infections or few infections, right? That's what traders do. They make money whether the stock market goes up or down, whatever happens. J.P. Morgan put out a paper saying, from what we see, ending lockdowns is associated with a decrease in new coronavirus infections, which is incredible. It suggests that all the pain that we've endured for this has been for nothing.
Okay, I'm sure you're aware of the situation with Jerry Falwell Jr. and Liberty University.
Yes.
Where, and there was a great piece by Bill McGurn in the Wall Street Journal about Liberty University, which I think is very striking and very much worth talking about, because when Jerry Falwell said that some students who wanted to come back to campus could come back to campus despite the lockdowns of other schools everywhere, people said this is going to be a bloodbath. They're going to have to pile the bodies high in all the hallways. And yeah, Apparently there isn't a single student who has tested positive for the coronavirus or has gotten sick.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
They said things about, yeah, because, I mean, it's extremely clear from anybody who's paid any attention to this for more than 2 months now, that coronavirus is not that serious a risk to anybody under the age of 50 who's healthy, you know, even a little bit older. And certainly if you're under the age of 30 and you don't have severe comorbidities, this is just not that serious an illness for you. That's not to say it's not serious for some people. It's not to say that, and certainly if you're elderly,
you
can be at risk. But for college students, this is nothing.
Okay, what about that stories that you keep hearing about the blood disease that is afflicting very young children, 7, 8, 9 years old, that is similar to Kawasaki disease and is often fatal?
Okay, so we don't know what this is. We know that Kawasaki disease is a real thing, and that there are inflammatory diseases that sometimes come in the wake of illnesses. That's not just coronavirus. That's the flu and other illnesses, enteroviruses. And those kill, in some cases they kill the children who get them. It is not clear that the coronavirus is causing this. There are some children who've had the virus who've gotten this. There are some children who've had the virus and recovered who've gotten it. There are some children who haven't had the virus at all and they've shown up with this. What we know, beyond a doubt, is that the media is jumping on every possible negative connection to coronavirus that it can. And now that we know that kids
Now that we know that kids
don't die from this at the time they get it, they're looking for another way to scare parents. I find it so disturbing.
Aside from scaring parents, one of the things that I paid a great deal of attention to was the modeling, and some of the modeling by Neil Ferguson in Great Britain has been ridiculous. Of course, we have not come close to the 2 million deaths that he was anticipating. However, the modeling that the president embraced was from the Institute for Medical Health Evaluation at the University of Washington. And they had originally predicted that before August 4th, there would be 60,000. Originally, they predicted more, then they dropped it to 60,000 dead Americans. We're already past that, and we're not anywhere close to August 4th. What do you say to modelers like that who undershot the amount of death that we've actually incurred?
So what we don't – okay. We need to be honest about who dies from coronavirus. The average age of death from people with coronavirus is about somewhere between 80 and 82. In states where coronavirus was introduced into nursing homes by governors, I mean, I don't want to say by governors, but where governors didn't take policies to protect people in nursing homes, there have been a lot of deaths. There's actually been very, very few hospitalizations of people with coronavirus, and that's, you know, the modeling has been consistently wrong on it. So what's happened? What's happened is that a bunch of really elderly, sick people have died, and they've been infected with coronavirus at the time they died. In some cases, they've died from coronavirus. In some cases, they've probably died with coronavirus. In some cases, it's practically impossible to tell. Neil Ferguson himself, the guy who came up with that original model from Imperial College, said that half to two-thirds of all the people who died from coronavirus would have died this year anyway. This is just another way of saying the same thing. This is a disease that targets older, sick people. Those are the people we should be protecting. Shutting down all society does very little to protect those people.
Okay, when you say they would have died anyway, what about the statistics, and you're very familiar with them, I know, about excess death that they're looking at? In other words, if you take the last 5 years and you take the average number of deaths for the last 5 years, we are way above that in almost every state.
No, we're not way above that in almost every state. We're way above that in one state, my state of New York. We're somewhat above that, not much in New Jersey and a couple other states. Nationally, we're not way above it at all. And again, if some people are dying right now, or you know, more realistically in May or April, who would have died in June or July, what we should think about is, What are the deaths going to look like at the end of the year? So almost 3 million people a year die in the United States every year. It will be interesting to see if we can see any excess mortality over 2020 compared to 2019 or 2018. I don't want to say it doesn't matter how many people die in a week. Of course it matters. Of course we don't want people to die. But if we're talking about the societal harm that we've done with the lockdowns, we need to look at more than 1 week. And like I said, we don't know yet, but the best estimates are that most of these people would have died by the end of the year anyway.
Okay, we will see at the end of the year. I certainly hope you're right, Alex Berenson. His book, which is on a completely different subject, is extraordinarily important and right on target. It is called Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. We will be right back on the issue of lockdowns, economy, restarts, and politics coming up on The MedVed Show.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael MedVed Show. That's 1-800-955-1776.
on the Michael Medved Show. I wish we could continue the conversation with Alex Barrazzo, if you want, not Alex Barrazzo, Alex Berenson. And by the way, they're two different people with similar names. Both Alex, both incredibly smart, but I think very different positions on the coronavirus. Alex Berenson is a former New York Times reporter. Alex Barrazzo is the one of the executive vice presidents of the American Council for Science and Health, who's also a frequent guest on this show. And no, they were not separated at birth, and no, they do not have the same last name. Alex Barrazzo is a PhD in microbiology, so I take him even more seriously. In terms of Alex Berenson, he may be contributing to the economic recovery, which we all so ardently want. There's a piece by William Galston, who is, I don't know how to describe his ideological point of view. He's a moderate-minded guy. He was part of the Clinton administration. He writes for the Wall Street Journal. And Bill Galston, it's Dr. Bill Galston, writes, government decisions shut down the economy. Yeah, they did, for better or worse. But simply reversing those decisions won't restore the status quo. In many sectors, demand has collapsed. Although airlines and hotels are operating, they have very few customers. The reason is pervasive fear, which will keep Americans from patronizing restaurants, bars, movie theaters, and other businesses long after states allow them to reopen. The economy will return to normal only when Americans no longer worry about contracting COVID-19. And that will only occur once reliable therapies and an effective vaccine are widely available. I think it could occur before that to some extent. And that, of course, is what the president is hoping for. And why he takes a more optimistic view of what this quarter will show. The Dow, by the way, today was up almost 400 points. It almost erased the losses yesterday. The S&P 500, the other big stock mark, is actually at the highest level it's been since early March. Really, in a long time. So there is confidence that this opening up of the against the pandemic is going to go well. I do think one of the things that troubles me about what Alex was saying about the mistaken policies here is that how do you then explain that some of the countries with the most firm, most energetic, most sweeping lockdowns are those that have been spared almost any death or destruction and very limited economic dislocation from the lockdowns? Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, Taiwan has done very well. And other countries like Great Britain, where Prime Minister Johnson was very slow. You may remember, he even refused to give up shaking hands. He defended shaking hands. Then he got the virus. And his country, in terms of the number of deaths per population, is twice as bad as the United States. Twice the human cost of the COVID-19 coronavirus. What is truly appalling, it seems to me, is not when people compare the United States to Australia or New Zealand or Israel, where there has been very, very successful. And again, Israel has about 1/8 the level of death as here in the United States. They had a very sweeping, very hard line, very strictly enforced orders keeping people at home. But when people compare the United States to China and our handling of this, China was largely responsible. In Cut 8, Jeremy, on MSNBC, of course, Keir Simmons had praise for China compared to the United States. Listen.
China really seeming to do the diplomacy better than America at this stage, where President Xi steps up and gives an address. We didn't know he was going to do that until hours before, and kind of steals the limelight. And here's one of the issues again, is there is no proposal from the White House for what to replace the World Health Organization with. So what is Britain or France or Germany or Australia supposed to do with this? Because, of course, you can't just pull out of a World Health Organization in the middle of a pandemic because President Trump wants you to, when there is no proposal for what to do instead.
Okay, we do need a proposal for what to do instead. And what President Trump has talked about is reforming the World Health Organization and to basically have the World Health Organization abandon the cover-up of Chinese malfeasance, of their misbehavior that did impact the rest of the world in an extraordinarily negative way. Then there is the continued effort to make absolutely everything about Trump. And I think it's deeply unfortunate. We're going to be speaking with Rich Lowry of National Review about that coming up. But the effort to personalize this about Trump took a new level on the Morning Joe program, again on MSNBC, with Joe Scarborough, this is cut number 5, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski talking about the irresistible subject of Trump and hydroxychloroquine.
He's saying he's taking hydroxychloroquine, yeah. something that a guy who's old, in his mid-70s, who's, I don't know, what is he? He's 270, 275, 280.
Maybe more, yeah.
He's got a lot of comorbidities. And a guy like that, who eats badly, doesn't sleep, no doctor is going to let him take a drug that his own administration, the Trump administration, has said could cause heart problems in older patients with comorbidities. And he is the definition of that, is heart problems in older patients with comorbidities. And he is the definition of that.
Okay, he just loves to repeat that phrase, heart problems, comorbidities. By the way, talking about President Trump's weight, it's not a state secret. When he had his last physical examination, which was about a year ago, he came out at 243 pounds. It's not sylph-like, it's not scrawny, but no, not the 280 or 275 or 270 that Mika and Joe were speculating. We'll come back with Rich Lowry of National Review. And how do you elevate the conversation at a time of polarization like this? Coming up on The Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, an honor to be joined by Rich Lowry. He is the editor of National Review. He is the author of the very important book, The Case for Nationalism. And he was also commended by President Trump in one of his, I think he had 4 press availabilities yesterday. He was just talking to the press. And we went to him live at one point, and what to my wondering ears should appear but a commendation of Rich Lowry? What is it that the president liked, Rich?
I think he liked I missed this one. He said so many things yesterday. I missed even the reference to myself yesterday, but I assume it was.
You did?
This is the first I learned of it, heard of it.
I'm glad to let you know. I mean, it's great. You're going to get a Medal of Freedom next. So what did you say or do that the president would like? He wouldn't like your editorial, The Idiotic Fight Over Hydrochloroquine. He wouldn't like that.
No, that would not be it. But I wrote a big piece on the administration's effort to secure PPE, which I think hasn't been told really comprehensively in the press, at least in non-hostile accounts. And there's no doubt the administration was slow, should have gotten going on things in January. But once it was really clear what was happening, they reacted in a deft, innovative, and pretty effective way. I mean, they invoked the so-called Defense Production Act, but not to nationalize companies. You know, they didn't want to be trying to run everything themselves on the fly, but to use companies, use their supply chains, use their logistics, use their data to direct protective equipment to the hotspots, to the hospitals that needed it the most. At the same time, they're partnering with 3M on some really big deals. 3M was making, I think, 22 million of these N95 respirators prior to the crisis. September, October, they'll be making 94 million a month here in the United States. And they got a deal to get a bunch, 166 million, over from China. And then they're flying a bunch of material over on government planes from Asia and especially from China. So, look, this is an enormous crisis. It created a huge gap in the market and a gap between the supply and the demand of this sort of stuff. You know, no one really has a metric for what success is in a case like this, because this is a 100-year event. But I don't think they get credit for being as energetic and in some cases shrewd as they have been.
Okay, Rich, when after the show, we'll find the clip and send it to you. You should hear it. He did cite, that was the article he cited. He said, this is a great story, and it was put forward by a great writer. Great writer. And he repeated, I think, twice and mentioned your name, Rich Lowry. So it's nice to get a presidential commendation when I know you've also presided over some articles and some commentary of your own that the president has not entirely appreciated. Let me ask you this, and in the limited amount of time we have, it right now appears as if the most recent projections from the Institute for Medical Health Evaluation at the University of Washington, the projections that the president and Secretary Mnuchin and other people pay attention to, is we're going to have about 130,000 dead in America by August 4th. The economy may have begun to turn around at that point. We seem to be in the process of ending the lockdowns pretty much everywhere. And what will that look like to the country at that point? What will be the talking points for the two candidates for president about how our nation has weathered this challenge?
Well, I think what Biden, I think it's pretty easy to say what they both say. It's kind of hard to figure how the public's going to react to it. Biden's going to say, look, you're unprepared, you're minimizing it from the start. And this has been a calamity. More than 100,000 people have died. And the economy is, went into depression levels of unemployment that we still haven't recovered from. It's your fault. And Trump will say, we got through the worst of it. The disease is on a major downward trajectory. We'll be much better prepared for any possible comeback of virus in the fall. And the economy is on an upward trajectory again, even if we have a lot of ways to go. So I just don't know how this is going to be received by the public. But certainly, you know, in the space of about 3 or 4 months, Trump went from having a tailwind of a historically tight labor market and a long economic run of incredible growth to the headwind of this virus, which, you know, the health effects have been really bad and the economic effects clearly a calamity.
Yeah, the Congressional Budget Office is predicting, and I look particularly at the time of the election, the unemployment rate will be around 10%. That's what they're anticipating. Now, what does that mean? In other words, the question will be, obviously, we'll be in the process of recovery after this huge shutdown. But do you think it's likely that the American people will begin feeling that recovery? I mean, certainly today, the stock market, Dow Jones up 380 points. If the market continues to do well, there's a chance that people would be more optimistic, don't you think?
Yeah, it just depends on whether that absolute unemployment rate, which easily could be in the double digits, does that matter most? You know, if you told me a year ago that the unemployment rate is going to be 10% or higher in November, I'd say, okay, Trump's cooked. Or is it the upward trajectory that matters? That beyond the politics, though, Michael, this has just been, it's a catastrophe for lower income people. It took about 10 years for the labor market to get into place after the financial crisis, where it was really cooking for those sort of blue-collar workers, non-college-educated workers. Finally, their wages were going up. Their wages were going up at a rate higher than people in the middle or the upper part of the income spectrum. And now they've just been clobbered by this. You know, their unemployment rates are much higher than anyone else's. Their jobs have been wiped out more than, you know, professionals like us. You know, we scribble and talk for a living. We can work remotely or in a studio alone, and they can't. They have to be out of these jobs. So that's just one of the many heartbreaking aspects of this, and we'll also play politically. You know, it'll matter a lot. You know, those voters, a lot of them were Trump voters, or went from Obama to Trump, and just how they'll feel about this in November obviously will play a big role.
Yeah, and speaking of which, there's breaking news that the Supreme Court has, at least for the time being, blocked release of the Mueller grand jury testimony, which is what the Trump administration wanted. It's victory for the Trump administration. And in the last minute, do you think that the effort to make Obamagate a major issue is going to gain political traction for the president?
No, I think Republicans are going to be focused on it. I think rightly. I think it's a legitimate story. But in terms of changing anyone's minds, there being a big voting issue in the fall, I have a hard time seeing that.
I would emphatically agree with you. Rich Lowry is the author of The Case for Nationalism. He is the editor of National Review. And they're now Jimmy Kimmel is talking about assassination, accusing Trump of becoming an assassin. We will play that for you and more coming up on The Medved Show.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. That's 1-800-955-1776.
As I mentioned to Rich Lowry during the last segment, The Hill is reporting the Supreme Court today denied a request from House Democrats for immediate access to redacted grand jury materials from former special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe. Is this some kind of epical event? Shouldn't we all be done with the Mueller probe? Really? It wasn't fun while it was going on, but it's over. The justices instead granted the Trump administration's request to continue shielding the grand jury transcripts, which are supposed to be secret, and exhibits, which are also supposed to be secret. The Wednesday order also gives the Justice Department until June 1st, coming up, to file a formal appeal of a lower court ruling that requires the administration to hand over the materials the Democratic-led House Judiciary Committee initially requested as part of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Now, is this a game changer in any way that the justices of the Supreme Court want the Justice Department to do a formal appeal of this lower court order about handing over this material to the House Judiciary Committee? No, this is about as inside baseball as it gets. And one of the things that, frankly, I find very, very depressing about both sides here, of both sides, is the desire to play this stuff and go over and over and over and over again about the early days of the administration and the rocky start that President Trump experienced. And it was a rocky start. And the obsession with Michael Flynn seems to me to always miss what is the one most pertinent question. When he was fired, he was not fired by James Comey. He was not fired by Barack Obama. He was not fired by Joe Biden. He was fired 3 weeks into his service as national security advisor by the president of the United States, Donald J. Trump. I believe President Trump did the right thing to fire Michael Flynn. Because you cannot have a national security advisor who lies to the vice president. He had lied to Mike Pence. How do we know? Mike Pence said so. Mike Pence is an honorable guy. So if that's the case, if Mike Flynn got fired from a job he had just assumed, and then after that actually got indicted and convicted, be pleaded guilty, if all of that happened to Michael Flynn, then was the president wrong to fire him? No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I mentioned Jimmy Kimmel. And again, this is part of rock star Greg Tomlin monitors the late night comedians. It's brutal, punishing work, but somebody's got to do it. So he does it. And he makes a point, and he's completely correct. These folks have, for the most part, just ceased being funny at all. They're just angry liberals. Really, really angry liberals. Listen to Jimmy Kimmel.
Why would he do this to prevent coronavirus and not wear a mask to prevent the virus? I thought about it for a long time last night. I've come to what I think is the only reasonable conclusion. He's trying to kill himself. Remember how we all said he didn't really want to be president? He wished he was home at Mar-a-Lago playing golf and finding ways to humiliate his friends, that he's miserable in the White House? Well, guess what? I think we were right, and I think he's had enough. I think he's worried he might get reelected. Donald Trump could be the first president who ever tried to assassinate himself, and somebody needs to watch him.
Okay, is that supposed to be funny? It seems to me that if you do watch the president, and I do, it's part of my job, he actually seems to be enjoying this job. And obviously he's full of energy. And I think he, you heard this. This was in the Washington Post, New York Times, all over the place, that he loved those coronavirus daily briefings. He enjoyed them. He wanted to continue them. His aide said, stop, stop, stop. This is harming your ratings. And his ratings right now are at an all-time high for Trump. He has 49%, according to Gallup, 49% approval from the country, which is higher than Obama was before he was reelected. It's higher than Bush was before he was reelected. So there's that. And then over the break, I just checked phone messages that came in, and I got several text messages that came in with people taking me to task for having accepted the White House version of Trump weighing 243 pounds. And people saying, he weighs at least 280. And someone saying, well, I'm 5'11", he's supposed to be 6'3". I know how much I weigh. People being very concerned about the president's weight. Can you remember this with any other president? Because I don't. I don't. And, Bill Clinton. With Bill Clinton, actually, there was a teasing about, but is this because he put those gym shorts on and would be jogging to McDonald's? And people noticed that Bill Clinton had fleshly thighs. But I don't believe that there was any debate about whether the president was telling the truth or the presidential physicians were telling the truth about his weight.
I haven't eaten at McDonald's.
The good old days. When we come back, there is a school board member in Fremont, Nebraska, who is attacking Senator Ben Sasse. For what? Ben Sasse gave a commencement address. It was completely non-political. I thought it was very funny. It made a lot of apt pop culture references. He was trying to seem cool and with it with the young graduates of his own high school. He had graduated from that high school 30 years before. Okay, I think Senator Sasse did fine. Chris Saliza on CNN says it's the worst commencement speech of all time. We'll let you decide. Also, there is a number here that birth rates are way down in the United States. And crime is way down during the pandemic in particular. How is that happening, and why is that happening at the same time? And Megan Rapinoe, remember her. She identifies President Trump as a white nationalist. And The CNN, again, saying that Trump is aligning himself with doctors who are the equivalent of climate change deniers, which, of course, for people on the left is a terrible, terrible thing to be. The question about the economy has to do with how soon the recovery kicks in and whether that is going to be soon enough to influence the election. Bill Galston of the Wall Street Journal writes that Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve describes the economic outlook as highly uncertain and subject to significant downside risk. And delay isn't cost-free. With every passing month, more businesses will fail, more workers will leave the labor force, and more households will suffer. So the answer, he says, and this seems to be the position of the head of the Federal Reserve, is a more government bailout money, both for businesses and for individuals. Now, nobody is going to approve that very partisan, very extreme Democratic passage that passed the House but isn't even going to be considered in the Senate. But does there need to be more government aid? And what do you do, if anything, about ever paying it down and getting a more close to livable budget for this greatest nation on God's green earth?